So the first Parliamentary Poet Laureate of Canada.
Yeah.
How was that?
It was in a way confused because I was the first one ever, so we had to figure out what I do, right? And a lot of it was the Parliamentary Library and me trying to decide what we're doing. And when people got, it was incredible at the beginning, the first couple of months, the press was all over it. It was unbelievable. The English press, the French press, TV, radio, newspapers, magazines, everybody was all over it. It was like I had to do several interviews a day for day after day after day after day, right? And some I couldn't do, some in French. My French is like terrible, but there we went. I had to, right? I even had to read some of my poems in French on CBC in Montreal. And it was like exhilarating and tiring. I couldn't believe how interested people were, and I think it was because it's a freak show, partly. It was so unusual, nobody'd ever heard of such a thing before, right?
How did it complicate border crossings?
Just that one time. So we're crossing the border, a border between southeastern Saskatchewan and I think North Dakota, and there's nothing there except there's nothing on the Canadian side. On the American side, there's a little shack, and one of those gates that has to be lifted up, and we're parked there for a long time trying to get back into the States because we were in the States before it came up to Saskatchewan and we're back down. We're going to baseball games, right? And this finally, this young guy with a huge gun comes out and starts asking us all the questions and everything and so forth, and it's like, he's going on a little bit longer than usual because he probably only gets 7 cars a day, right? So, and I look over at Gene and I say, can I? Should I? I'm going to, you know, if he asks, I'm going to. And I said, come on, just let me, just this once, okay? And she says, oh, well, right. So finally the guy asks, he says, and what do you do for a living? And I looked over at Gene and I said, I looked around at him, he's got these mirror sunglasses, of course, and I say to him, I am the Parliamentary Poet Laureate of Canada. And there's like a silence out on the plains for a while. And he says, step out of the car. And he says, would you open the trunk of your car? So I opened the trunk of the car, and it's got, you know, a bunch of our bags and stuff in it, and it's got a box with my poem Baseball, which has just been reprinted after, it was published in 1967, it's just been reprinted in 04 or whatever it was, 03. 03. It's like it's very peculiar little triangle thing, it looks like a pen, and it's got a green flocky cover, and it says Baseball with George Bowring, and it's like, open it up, and it's a diamond, right? And it's a poem I wrote in 1965, and as a matter of fact, Jack Spicer dies in the middle of the poem, right? Because he died when I was about to the 6th inning of the 9 innings in the book. He looks at this box with these green things, and he says, what's that? Because he sees there's a number of them, right? And, you know, they're always worried that we might be going down there to sell something in the U.S. And he says, what's that? And I said, it's my new book. And he says, you call that a book? I would have given him one, you know, but it's like $18.95 Canadian dollars.
$18.95?
That's what the price is normally, or $17.95.
We got a discount here?
I was giving him here for $10. Big deal.
Wow.
That's the kind of guy I am.
I guess so.
Yeah.
He so, didn't get one.
He didn't get one. No.
But he also didn't put on any rubber gloves to give you the real search.
So no, I didn't.
He got off easy in a way.
My cavities were okay.
Your cavities were okay, dental and otherwise. Is it something about the Canadian distaste for pretension and ego that created a ground from which something like the Martyrology could emerge, something that we talked about as being perhaps the most important epic poem in North America?
David Rosenberg, the great biblical scholar and poet, says he's persuaded he's going to be working on it. He is already working on it.
And we're talking about the B.P. Nichol poem.
Yeah, and he says that B.P. Nichol's Martyrology is like the most important long poem of the 20th century, because he stopped writing in 1988 because he died, and he says that it is to the 20th and 21st century as the writings that constitute the Jewish Bible are to the Jewish religion, right? That's how important the Martyrology is.
Why is that? What is it about them?
Well, it's a very, very successful long poem, and it is amongst, you know, Canadian readers, not all Canadian readers, but among Canadian readers of poetry, of serious poetry, it's a classic. And but David Rosenberg said it outdoes Pound and Olson, because it has the attention to a huge world, to a universe, to use Olson's term, that they have, that both of those guys who spent 50 years writing their poems have, while he's pounded. But it has more. It has what they don't have. He said that neither Pound nor Olson ever understood themselves. They never knew themselves, right? And that what they knew was a world that they could put, what they had, you know, the whole thing we were taught about the modernists was they had a persona, right? And Pound puts out a persona, obviously, all the time. And so does Olson. Olson's still,
Maximus.
I, Maximus, blah, 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 right? But he hasn't got the nerve. In fact, he puts off the self. That's why he said, you know, I mean, I believe him, what he says in Projective Verse about the sprawl of the ego as being
the
a bad thing.
The lyrical interference of the ego.
Yeah, that's right. Sprawl. You can do nothing. He who would sing himself can do nothing but sprawl, or something like that, or wherever the words go.
And predating the notion of suburban sprawl,
yeah.
Also as pernicious, if not more so.
Well, he was beginning to see that sort of thing in the early poems when he was like in that thing about the jukebox. It said, music, 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 right? Because he saw that even the jukebox, like the jukeboxes, like the music, you're not going to get the music. You go to a little town and you go to on the seaboard, in the eastern seaboard, and you're not going to hear somebody playing a violin or a squeeze box or something like that. You're going to hear the same goddamn song in the jukebox that they're playing that day in El Paso, and the jukeboxes are owned and filled by the mob, right? So he didn't like, but on the other side of that was, yeah, so he's right about that, the ego, but...
But still, the lyrical interference of the ego perhaps prevented Olson from achieving what you says, what you believe B.P. Nichol.
Yeah, Olson. Olson. We don't get a deep. I don't know if there are any Williams. We almost do, but not quite. I don't know who we might get it from in American literature. This like deep understanding. We do get it in some of the European writers. Right?
And we get it from Nichol because of his day job. Is that part of it?
Well, it might have been. Yeah, he was a guy actually who was once he was trained to be a school teacher, and then he just like wouldn't do it. Right, it was like the wrong structure for his life. Yeah, so he was involved in a group called Therafields, in which the distinction between the patient, if that's what you want to call him, and the therapist has disappeared. Where when you go into that situation, you're both of those things. You can't go into that situation unless you need that therapy. It's a group oriented, but you also can't just go in it and be a, like some kind of dependent patient, right? You can't be just one of those two things. It has a great deal to do with that understanding of the self. Yeah.
But the other part of it is the cultural ground from which it comes. You know, in America, it's always another hero. You know, the cowboy, you know, rescues things before sunset. You know, the whole Ronald Reagan, Arnold Schwarzenegger thing. I hope the sneer in my voice is coming through when I talk about this. But there's a distaste for that in Canada in terms of pretension.
We never would have put up with the action painters. Like, the action painters are all big, macho, competitive guys, right? I can drink a lot. I can fight a lot. You know, I can paint these gigantic, monstrous canvases, right? And I'm better than any of you guys. And if you don't think so, I'll beat the shit out of you in the bar, right? It's like that. Oh man, we're something. Those painters never would have got anywhere in Toronto, right? Very odd. And there's a little bit of that in Olson too. It's a little bit of that. You know, that I'm a big guy walking through the universe. But on the other hand, I'd rather have that than some of those dainty little Iowa poets noticing the small fish in the riverbank, right?
So how does someone begin to go about reading the Martyrology? Very difficult.
Luckily, I had a graduate student when I was a teacher, and she just fell in love with B.P. Nichol's work. and did a lot of it shortly after he died. And she was allowed to go and mess around with his computer and sit in his office and so forth, and it'd drive her nuts because she'd find one of his hairs in the rug and all that, right? So she wrote she wanted to write a thesis, and I said, we need a concordance to the martyrology. So she wrote a concordance to the first couple books of the martyrology, and that was her thesis.
And this woman is?
Nakota, her name is Irene Nakota. She's now out of that life entirely into like cooking or something, but she was like a genius on that, and really smart. But that's only the first couple of books of the martyrology, and there's 10 books altogether. But reading those, you might begin to, while you're reading the couple of first books of the martyrology, you might get an idea about how to go later on. But the martyrology is a little bit, in some ways, like Louis Zukofsky's A, in that it can afford different kind. Every book in the martyrology has a different project, and one of them is even like music, as is Zukofsky's A. One of the books is entirely orchestral symbol on the page. And one of the books is so much, the structure of it is so strange that it's only one line long. But it's a line that has so many parentheses in it that you have to keep going in and out and in and out and in and out of the parentheses, and you have to read the damn thing 500 times to figure out what it's saying. One of them is chains. One of them is one where you finish one section of the poem and then it has two numbers underneath it, like 5 and 31, and you can either choose to go forward to section number 5 or to section number 31, depending on that, suggesting that you, the reader, are the only one that's going to come up with a structure for this poem, and no other reader is going to come up with the same structure for the poem, right? You want to figure out how you can do that, and that's how that was one way of figuring out how to do it.
In techniques like that, would you say that's how he was a technician of the potent?
Well, it's hard to talk about him, to start talking about him and not to have some kind of visual help, because he was a concrete poet. And like for him, a letter was a word, and a word was a sentence. Like seriously, right? And his understanding of the world, a lot of it had to do with, like, and you're trying to understand his poetry, has to take that into, like, he knows everything that has ever happened to that thing that became the letter H. And he knows everything that you can do with that, what is the letter H, right? And in a spiritual sense, and a psychological sense, and a grammatical sense, and a orthographical sense, and it's just incredibly complex, unbelievable. And yet, Beep was there are hundreds and hundreds of people, of major poets and nothing poets, and people who decided to add hell with being poets and so forth, that will tell you that, like, he was like the saint of their life.
You have an essay that mentions the phrase technician of the potent, that the poet... Of course, Technicians of the Sacred is the Rothenberg anthology.
Yeah.
Tell us about what you mean by technician of the potent.
Oh, I can't even remember now, but a lot of it had to do with...
Well, it just so happens.
So a lot of it has to do with a thing that Fred Waugh had been saying about the potent. But that was like, that's an argument that I was writing years ago. Come on, who can remember? I might not even agree with what I said back then, for God's sake.
Well, I have it in here somewhere. But that notion that the poem has, that the power is there.
That the power is not in the writer, for one thing, right? That the power, that you don't have to look to like some deity for the power, although that might be a good idea at times. But that the power to unleash what's there is already in the language. It's already in like the alphabet. It's in the dictionary. It's in the life of the language, right? I suppose.
So the notion of, and this is something you talked about in the class, the notion of you using the language is really kind of silly.
Yeah, it is. Like you, it's like it's like I think I will use the lens. I think I will use those. I think I'll use God. Well, see, it says here that I'm saying that Fred Waugh said that the poet is a technician of the potent, right? Yeah. This is good.
I thought so too, and it's online.
Yeah.
Is that the UToronto website, I think? Or I'm not sure. I saw that when I was preparing for the interview.
Oh, this is, oh yeah, I guess it is. Yeah, his writing philosophy. I haven't actually, I didn't know this was on there.
Well, it's quite good. But since you're not familiar with it, what about a poem?
Yeah, the hell with it.
Well, we have
it. But I would advise reading it.
Well,
if tell them where it is.
Well, it's www.library.utoronto.ca/canpoetry/bowering/write, W-R-I-T-E dot H-T-M. How's that? We should have a link on the website if we're doing our homework, and you're going to have at least one more poem for us then.
Here's a poem that that quotes Paul Blackburn at the beginning, and it's what it was. It was written January 1990, and it's the envoy of this George Bowring selected poem. My family's all in bed. I'm up against the silences to come. They keep telling me to talk more, write less. But I can't figure this out. I will be doing neither soon enough. And think, when the ears that hear me talk are dead, I'm done forever talking. But someone, dear descendant, might read a page out loud in the 21st century, her familiar time. And there I'll be, no book, etc., where neither you nor I can hear me. But closing the book, someone will close my words on each other. Maybe these I'm writing in a lorn kitchen, dark January outside, a lot of silence in this place. And it starts with Paul Blackburn and ends with Jack Kerouac.
Thanks for all your time for this week and for being on the program. It's been a sheer delight.
Well, I enjoyed it, both of them. And I should point out that Paul is sitting here completely naked.